Stopping Mass Killings in Africa. Conclusion. Dr. Douglas C. Piper. Genocide scholars, journalists, and activists have contributed substantially to understanding the causes and conduct of genocide and to altering the public and policymakers' potential and ongoing genocidal crises. Where they have fallen short is in providing concrete, operational advice on how intervention forces can stop mass killing and what sort of capabilities intervening forces must have in order to accomplish that mission. Those tasked with stopping genocide soon discover that no doctrine exists for genocide intervention, since genocide intervention falls neither in the realm of peacekeeping nor within the realm of warfighting. Models, recommendations, and best practices for uncontested humanitarian interventions and peacekeeping are not useful as guides to stopping the deliberate, organized killing of one group by another. Warfighting doctrines are unsuitable because intervening forces, whether UN, regional, or US, seek to avoid becoming belligerents, if possible. Support for intervention missions will be extremely limited if put in terms of making war for humanitarian purposes. The closest framework is the concept of peace enforcement operations. Even here, doctrinal guidance is unhelpful, if not misleading. The JP307.3 Peace Operations maintains that peace operation forces, termed PO forces, in the joint publication must still act impartially, even when conducting peace enforcement operations. The publication blatantly instructs intervening forces to restore order and forcibly separate belligerent parties while using restraint and minimum force. How this is to be done remains unclear. Military commanders must anticipate that genocide intervention will pose particular challenges in that intervention forces should not treat killers and victims impartially. Furthermore, restoring order may involve removing civil authorities rather than supporting and reinstalling them, as suggested by JP307.3. The preceding case studies provide a sense of the challenges and possibilities for genocide intervention missions, drawing upon specific historical examples rather than contrived generic scenarios or the ongoing evolving emergency in Darfur. Each case study seeks to provide a sense of specific context, with the first case study focusing on Somalia, 1992 to 1993. The second and third, Rwanda, during the spring of 1994, and last, the Côte d'Ivoire, during the period of 2002 to 2005. The case studies provide overviews of the causes, conduct, and contours of genocide within these particular settings, with specific analysis as to whether and how the intervention might have been more effective. In each case, the authors caution that prevention is preferable to intervention, but assert that if intervention becomes necessary, air power can contribute to the mission's success. Aaron Stephens provides a set of strategic and operational lessons for the intervention operations based on his analysis of UNISOM, UNITAF, and UNISOM II missions in Somalia in the early 1990s. At the strategic level, Stephens argues that prevention would have been much less costly than intervention, and that there were at least three clear opportunities prior to the formation of UNISOM I where U.S. leadership and U.N. involvement might have mitigated the Somali crisis. He argues that early intervention is always better than crisis intervention and notes that setting time limit to these missions, while popular with the public and military, desirous of clear exit strategies, can undermine the prospects for success. At the operational level, Stephens cautions that in complex contingency operations, one cannot artificially separate humanitarian intervention from nation building. In Somalia, famine and mass starvation could not be addressed merely by airlifting food and supplies into the country. The deliberate manipulation of food supplies by militias and clan factions had to be stopped. Stephens argues that nation building and the forms of political reconstruction, demobilization, and disarmament was a precondition for success. Even at the operational level, there is a need to tightly integrate and unify diplomatic, military, and humanitarian efforts. This will prove challenging. Stephens and other authors recommend that regional organizations provide the manpower for intervention, with the U.S. focusing on airlift and logistical support. As for the UNITAF, quantity of coercive air power, Stevens issues a warning. In Somalia, the use of AC-130 gunships signaled a departure from the coercion of blunt force attack, and it represented a declaration of war. George Stanley and Keith Reeves examined the failure to intervene in Rwanda in 1994 and provide assessments of whether and how intervention might have prevented genocide. Stanley noted that a Carnegie Commission panel concluded that a modern force of 5,000 troops drawn primarily from a single contributing country and inserted between April 7th and 21st could have significantly altered the outcome. While not contesting this assessment, Stanley noted that the risk level would not have been low and that military planners could not have assumed a passive environment for intervention. The French intervention operation of summer 1994, Operation Turquoise, encountered little opposition in part because it avoided injecting French troops into the maelstrom of an ongoing genocide and did more to assuage the moral sensibilities of the French public after the genocide had run its course than it did to stop the killings. While warning that intervention carried more risk than many contend and echoing Alan Cooperman's contention that a 7th of April through 21st of April intervention time frame was unrealistic, Stanley asserts that any intervention would have likely saved thousands of Tutsi lives. Had the political will existed, an intervention might have been possible, with air power playing a central role. Rapid intervention hinges on airlift, and only a few nations possess the sort of strategic airlift that would have enabled rapid intervention. Yet, beyond airlift, air power could have played an important role in impeding the Rwandan genocide. Stanley notes that RTL radio played a key role in instigating and guiding Rwanda's killers. Its broadcast could have been disrupted by deploying an EC-130 commando solo aircraft, clearly sending a signal that genocide would not be tolerated and complicating the efforts of the genocidaries. Furthermore, reconnaissance aircraft could have been deployed to locate roadblocks and disseminate warnings. While not available at the time, the MQ-1 Predator now provides the reconnaissance capabilities that can be deployed into non-passive environments without risk to intervening or monitoring forces. As a last resort, Stanley notes that aircraft could have been used to directly attack roadblocks manned by militia, though collateral damage in the form of civilian casualties would have been the price of directly applying firepower to dismantle checkpoints. Keith Reeves applies air power theory to examine genocide as a system, to identify the system's critical vulnerabilities and connections, and to construct a model for rapid genocide intervention, or RGI. Much of students and instructors at the Air Corps Tactical School in the 1930s sought to uncover the vulnerabilities of modern warfare by examining the industrial web that generated and supported it. So Reeves seeks to find the organizational connections that sustain genocide. He argues that the Rwandan genocide, far from being a primitive, spontaneous, and poorly orchestrated expression of hate, was instead a complex, highly organized effort sustained by a network of connecting political actors, civil authorities, Rwandan armed forces, and militia such as the Intihahwe and the Imputamugambi. Applying more recent air power theory that postulates that one can cause the strategic paralysis of an enemy by applying rapid, simultaneous, and parallel attacks on the components of the enemy's military system, Reeves argues that one should consider this approach to genocide. His concept of RGI envisions disrupting ongoing genocide by targeting the connections between the supporting components of the genocide machinery. Reeves notes that disrupting genocide is only an interim solution, but argues that a rapid, short-term response buys time and saves lives so that longer-term responses can be generated. Reeves' concept of rapid genocide intervention rests on the three pillars: broad resolve, timely intelligence, and rapid reaction. And keeping with the book's focus on operational responses, Reeves provides little detail about how to generate that sort of broad international resolve necessary for rapid, timely, and effective responses to genocide. Instead, he focuses on the other two elements of RGI, timely intelligence and rapid reaction. Reeves notes that at the strategic level, non-governmental organizations such as the Human Rights Watch and Genocide Watch already are providing alert, watches, and warnings of impending mass killings. National and international agencies can act on these alerts and gather additional assessments of conditions on the ground. At the operational level, Reeves notes that reconnaissance aircraft and UAVs could provide more detailed information, monitoring conditions, and providing timely intelligence of where and how mass killings are taking place. The third element of his concept, rapid reaction, rests on airlift and air mobility. Reeves' ideal force for RGI would be regional in composition, with the United States and or NATO providing air assets ranging from strategic and tactical airlift assets to helicopter and reconnaissance craft. The final case study of the volume, Timothy Boyer's examination of the Côte d'Ivoire during the period of 2002 to 2005, analyzes a case of successful genocide prevention. Boyer notes that by 2002, the Côte d'Ivoire was at stage 6, preparation of the Stanton genocide model. The Ivorian state showed numerous signs of impending failure and exhibited almost all CERD indicators of potential genocide. According to Boyer, a highly probable genocide was averted through an effective combination of a nation acting unilaterally, France, regional or sub-regional organizations, ECOWAS, and a major operation by an international organization, UNOCI. While less theoretical than Reeves' case study, Boyer's provides an example of the sort of assets and capabilities that stopped an impending genocide. French intervention, Operation Leconte, was fairly robust, consisting of some 4,000 troops and air detachment of 17 helicopters and two C-160 Transall aircraft. Most interestingly, UNOCI set up its own radio station so it could communicate the mission of its 8,000 uniformed personnel directly to the local population. Boyer concludes that Operation Leconte and regional and international intervention efforts provide valuable models for addressing the threat of imminent genocide. While direct U.S. involvement was minimal, U.S. diplomatic and economic support of ECOWAS and later of UNOCI forces was important, helping to fund trucks, jeeps, and communications equipment. French air power, both in the form of airlift and in the form of helicopters, served as a vital enabler of Operation Leconte, with the French mission working closely with UNOCI and damping down violence. The case studies show that specific context matters and caution that prevention is less costly and more effective than intervention. Yet in seeking operational solutions to stopping ongoing mass killings, each case study posits that air power might have played a valuable role beyond simply transporting and sustaining peacekeeping troops. Given that the U.S. Air Force has devoted little thought to genocide intervention, perhaps it is fitting to summarize and explore air power's capabilities in this realm. Air power alone cannot stop ongoing genocide, but it can support and assist intervention efforts in ways overlooked. This is especially important in that the U.S. public has a limited appetite for sustained nation building, and the notion of deploying significant numbers of U.S. ground troops to Darfur, the Congo, and other crisis areas is unrealistic given current overstretch and competing commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan. Rather than focusing on operational responses that call for U.S. boots on the ground, a better U.S. strategy for genocide intervention would be to support regional or U.N. forces through the small U.S. expeditionary forces providing key enabling capabilities. Regional and U.N. peace enforcement missions tend to be weakest precisely in those areas where the United States and its Air Force excel: strategic airlift and theater mobility, communications, ISR, medical evaluation, medevac, and emergency care, radio suppression and broadcasting, and, as a last resort, coercive air power. The U.S. Air Force already has the organizational construct to provide an expeditionary force that could support and assist regional or U.N. intervention ground forces engaged in genocide intervention and peace enforcement. In 1998, then the Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, General Michael Ryan, and Acting Secretary of the Air Force, F. Witten Peters, launched a reorganization of the Air Force for the very purpose of generating enhanced capability to deploy and sustain air and space expeditionary task forces, AETF. These task forces, ranging in size from wings to groups to squadrons, each have built-in command, control, and staff support structures and are fully tailorable forces. The Air Force has emphasized that all personnel and assets should fall within the framework of this expeditionary construct. While task forces deployed in Iraq and Iran have focused on supporting U.S., NATO, and coalition warfighters, the concept of organizing an AETF with the sort of capabilities that lend themselves to supporting non-U.S. regional forces or UN operations is entirely reasonable. Devising genocide intervention strategies and operational concepts will be highly contextual. The concept of safe havens, for example, was appropriate for Kurdish Iraq, problematic in Bosnia, and inappropriate in Rwanda, where Tutsi intermingled with Hutu and roadblocks impeded movement. Likewise, imposing no-fly zones depends on local conditions. A no-fly zone might have protected Shiites in southern Iraq from Sudan's ruthless post-Desert Storm subjugation campaign in which Iraqi helicopters played a crucial role. Yet, even a massive Allied air presence over Kosovo in 1999 could not have stopped Serbian ground forces from terrorizing and expelling Kosovar civilians. Rather than focusing on devising detailed operational plans for stopping genocide, the United States should focus on developing small expeditionary task forces that provide regional and international organizations with capabilities they sorely lack. Some of these key capabilities follow. Strategic and theater air mobility and airlift support. The U.S. Air Force clearly understands the importance of strategic airlift in genocide intervention operations and already directly contributes to African Union operations in Darfur by transporting and supplying various contingents. By 2003, for example, the 786th Expeditionary Squadron operating out of Ramstein Air Base, Germany, has conducted 7 missions transporting Rwandan contingents into the region. Its C-130s, along with C-17s from Charleston Air Force Base, South Carolina, have provided the essential strategic airlift underpinning the operation, with the Air Force personnel also contributing to airfield operations. Yet strategic airlift is only part of the equation. Intervention forces, once transported into the region, often lack theater mobility. The UN African Union mission in Darfur, UNAMID, which replaced the African Union's only operation in Darfur in early 2008, has faced great difficulties in finding donor nations willing to supply helicopters and tactical airlift assets. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon commented in January 2008 that, in the past weeks and months, I have contracted personally every possible contributor of helicopters in the Americas, in Europe, in Asia, and yet not one helicopter has been available yet. Ban Ki-moon attributed the difficulty of finding donors to lack of political will, with unnamed diplomats at the United Nations elaborating that past attacks on helicopters have dampened the enthusiasm of donor nations loath to put their valuable aviation assets at risk. In short, the United Nations understands the need for theater mobility. It simply cannot find countries willing to contribute to filling this vacuum. The U.S. Air Force, which has staked the claim to be the leading service in air power, not simply U.S. Air Force thought, should move beyond simply patting itself on the back for supplying the indispensable long-range airlift that underpins many crisis intervention operations. Building on the mechanism of AETF, it should cobble together the expeditionary task force that provides ground-centric UN or regional peacemakers with theater and tactical air mobility as well. This may well entail drawing on U.S. Army and U.S. Marine Corps components with an expeditionary airlift package conceivably including Air Force C-130s, Army CH-47 transportation helicopters, and Marine Corps MB-22 Osprey tilt-wing rotor aircraft. The numbers required would be limited. UNAMID, currently slated to become one of the largest UN missions to date, desperately seeks 24 helicopters. Operation Le Cornet, the French intervention effort, and the Côte d'Ivoire, supported its sustained ground forces with an initial aviation contingent consisting of a single Fennec light helicopter, which was reinforced by 2 SA-330 Cougars, helicopters originally developed by Sud Aviation called Pumas, if assembled by Westland Helicopters, of the COS, Commandant d'Opérations Spéciales, or French Special Operations Command, and a Transall C-160 of ET-2.64, Escadrille de Transport Armé Lier, or French Air Force Transport Squadron. Another Transil, 4 Gazelles, another Saud Aviation-developed helicopter from the 5RHC, Régiment d'Hélicoptère Combat Aviation Légère de l'Armée de Terre, or French Army Aviation Combat Helicopter Regiment, and two Pumas were added subsequently. Communication support. While the U.S. Air Force can and should take the lead in providing airlift and mobility to peacekeeping forces, it can contribute in many other ways, with communication support leading the way. UN and regional forces are often poorly equipped with communications gear and support, and at times are dependent on contractor support, which may evaporate if the situation becomes dangerous. This is no indictment of private contractor support, but contractors who have signed up to support peacekeeping and monitoring missions may be unprepared for peace enforcement. Lieutenant General Romeo Delar, recalling the communications capability of his small UNAMIR force, wrote that it was difficult to get the messages to the troops in the field. Getting messages to headquarters was equally difficult. They either had to be hand-delivered, a problem when both fuel and vehicles are at a premium, or relayed over the radio network. Unfortunately, our Motorola radios, unlike those carried by both RPF and RGF, had no encryption capability. As for communicating with UN headquarters, Delar depended on contractor support to operate and maintain his satellite communications. Luckily for him, six of his civilian communications staff had insisted on staying with UNAMIR after the rest of their colleagues had been evacuated, even though they were living in squalor. A small AETF that could provide robust, secure, and dependable communications and support personnel to the regional and UN commanders engaged in genocide intervention missions would be immensely valuable. ISR support. The U.S. Air Force excels at providing timely operational ISR support to ground commanders, a capability that many regional and international organizations sorely lack. UN and regional peacekeepers operate largely in the dark once observation posts are overrun and established separation lines are ignored. The Dutch commander in charge of the southern sector of the Srebrenica safe zone in 1995, for example, had to send out one of his armored personnel carriers to find the enclave's new front line. Once Serbs rolled past his observation post, most recently an African Union observation mission in Darfur was overrun by rebel forces on the 30th of September 2007, suffering 10 dead, 10 wounded, 30 missing in action. The lightly equipped African Union forces apparently had no idea of the size or strength of the rebel groups forming in the area. The U.S. Air Force certainly could support intervention missions by sharing satellite imagery, by launching reconnaissance aircraft, or by deploying the sophisticated Global Hawk RQ-4 UAV. This support would be costly and contested, given concurrent demands in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. Far more useful would be less costly, low-tech ISR assets, such as the Army's Tactical Hunter or Raven UAVs. Furthermore, considering that the likelihood of genocide is high in many areas of the world, where the main challenge to reconnaissance and observation crafts comes from manned portable air defense systems, man pads, missiles, the Air Force should consider the utility of substituting disposable high-altitude observation balloons for scarce satellite imagery, rather than thinking in terms of U.S. boots on the ground in crisis areas such as Darfur, Somalia, and the Congo. The U.S. should support regional and international forces by providing them with ISR capabilities so that the reconnaissance rests on more than conclusion. Armed troops. Medevac and field hospital support. One of the key challenges to intervention forces embarked on peace enforcement operations is providing emergency care and timely medical evacuation to peace enforcers. While Blue Helmet peacekeepers can claim that both sides have acknowledged their special neutral status and therefore are obligated to assist in evacuating injured personnel, forces intervening to stop genocide must recognize that they have taken sides and may well be the target of those whose genocidal campaign they intend to thwart. Indeed, these groups conducting genocide may specifically target intervening forces in order to demoralize, stun them into passivity, or convince the populace of the contributing country to withdraw their forces. This certainly was the case in Rwanda, when Hutu extremists intentionally targeted Belgian peacekeepers in the correct belief that the Belgian government would react by withdrawing its forces. Providing timely medical evacuation and emergency care is essential if third-party forces are expected to put their lives on the line to protect innocents. Depending on contractors to provide medevac services can be risky. When the situation deteriorated in Rwanda in 1994, for example, the two helicopters that the United Nations had contracted to provide this service simply disappeared. Lieutenant General Dallaire later commented, "With the country exploding, the pilots had fled to Uganda. They were both contract employees, so who could blame them?" But the result was that we were confined to Kigali with no ability to evacuate casualties. In all likelihood, any seriously wounded would die. And every decision I was to take over the coming weeks, I had to balance the risk of the operations against the fact that we had no medical safety net. The U.S. military leads the world in the field of medical evacuation and emergency care. In Iraq, some 90% of the wounded U.S. soldiers survived, compared to some 75% in the compared to some 75% during the Vietnam and Korean Wars, and around 70% during World War II. The Air Force's aeromedical evacuation teams and the large Air Force Theater Hospital at Balad, Iraq, played an important role in saving U.S. lives. Over 96% of the injured service personnel who make it to the Balad Field Hospital survive, with urgent priority patients air evacuated within the average of 13.2 hours to even more capable facilities and Landstuhl, Germany, or to the continental United States. The Department of Defense's medical establishment is hard-pressed dealing with U.S. casualties flowing in from Iraq and Afghanistan. But should a smaller American footprint in the Middle East result in decreased U.S. casualties, the United States is capable of providing a critical niche service that regional and international peace enforcement missions lack. The United States could boost the effectiveness of these efforts by offering mobile battalion aid stations, a small field hospital, and aeromedical evacuation services. If appropriate, the United States could back intervention efforts by stationing hospital ships such as the USNS Mercy or USNS Comfort in the region to receive injured peacemakers. These assets should not be seen as substitutes or alternatives to the large-scale efforts of the NGOs, such as the Red Cross, Doctors Without Borders, or Refugees International, but rather as an enabling component supporting the intervention forces that would create an environment where large-scale humanitarian intervention is possible. Radio suppression, broadcasting capability, and strategic communication support. The case studies on Rwanda and the Côte d'Ivoire point out the importance of radio in instigating and organizing genocide. Radio RTLM in Rwanda, and in preventing it and garnering support of peace enforcement. ONUCI-FM in Côte d'Ivoire. Over the course of the Cold War, the United States spent hundreds of millions of dollars on electronic warfare and has various platforms at its disposal capable of conducting offensive electronic countermeasures such as jamming. In addition, the United States has devoted considerable thought and treasure to psychological operations and strategic communications. Currently, the U.S. military has organizations and platforms capable of both message suppression and promulgation. The U.S. Army's 4th Psychological Operations Group and the U.S. Air Force's 193rd Special Operations Wing have specialists trained in generating positive messages in support of operations, with the EC-130's commando solo aircraft capable of suppressing undesired radio broadcasts and substituting alternative radio transmissions. These assets might not be deployed directly as part of an AETF supporting peace enforcement and genocide intervention operation, but the American commander should be aware of their potential and offer these capabilities to the commander. Coercive air power. As a final option, the United States can provide coercive capabilities to the peace enforcement commander. The U.S. Air Force has embraced this mission above all others, as evidenced by the pattern that every single chief of staff of the Air Force since its creation in 1947 has been either a bomber or fighter pilot. The U.S. Air Force could certainly provide a wide array of coercive options to peace enforcement commanders, but should remain reticent about employing coercive air power for three reasons. First, the intent of offering an air power support package for peace enforcement is to assist and support the efforts of non-U.S.-led regional and international intervention missions. U.S. forces should act as force multipliers for others and refrain from taking over and leading intervention efforts directly. Yet, inevitably, once U.S. coercive air power is employed, our superior technology and capability will shift leadership of the intervention effort from other nations to ourselves. This might be justified if coercive air power had a proven record of effectiveness in protecting civilians and stopping mass killings. This is far from the case. Air power did indeed deter Saddam Hussein from crushing the Kurdish north of Iraq, as he did the Shia South following his defeat in 1990, but it proved entirely ineffective in stopping Serb paramilitaries moving out the hundreds of thousands of Kosovars in 1999. Coercive air power can act as a shield and a sword for ground commanders, protecting ground forces and pushing those who attack them. It is far less effective at shielding civilians from light ground forces intent on slaughtering them. Nor is it easy to distinguish perpetrators from victims from thousands of feet in the air. This is the second reason to be wary of using coercive air power. The vaunted pinpoint accuracy of our weapon systems does not eliminate the possibility of civilian casualties and collateral damage. As Stevens points out, as Stephens points out in his case study on Somalia, the airstrike against an alleged Somali National Alliance Command Center killed up to 70 traditional clan leaders and civilians, most of them unassociated with IED. The use of coercive air power may well have accomplished the opposite of its intended effect, increasing IED's influence and prestige rather than diminishing it. As for the feasibility of demolishing the killing barricade where Hutu militia massacred Tutsi civilians, this could hardly have been done without killing many of the civilian onlookers and cheerleaders. One might make the case that the humanitarian war is justified, but the United States could well find itself scapegoated and pilloried should it cause collateral damage in employing coercive air power. We should set a high threshold before employing coercive air power as an instrument of peacemaking. Only after intervention ground forces have confronted, cajoled, and done their very best to stop mass killings from up close should we resort to doing so from far high in the skies. Lastly, we should be wary of employing coercive air power because of the cascading dynamics it will introduce into the AETF, or Joint Task Force, supporting genocide intervention efforts. Air mobility communication support, aeromedical evacuation, and psychological operations will receive a smaller proportion of the commander's attention once he or she begins to tackle the challenge of employing coercive air power. Nonetheless, should the intervention force commander need coercive air power, some form of it should be available. The form and level of force will depend greatly on context. If intervening against groups that have no air power, or an extremely limited air force, then helicopter gunships, AV-8 carrier aircraft, and AC-130 gunships will suffice. In cases where the enemy has an air force that needs to be deterred from operating, more advanced aircraft may be necessary. An element of coercive air power should be put at the disposal of the intervening force in recognition of the wisdom of President Theodore Roosevelt's adage, "Speak softly and carry a big stick." Yet both the force commander and the AETF commander should think hard before employing that stick. Wide array of actors is pressing for action to stop the mass slaughters of civilians. Yet genocide, while distinct from war in that it intentionally targets civilians and non-belligerence for death, often occurs during warfare. Governments use the veil of war to exterminate entire groups they dislike or fear, simultaneously manipulating public wartime passions while stamping out dissent. Yet war is not genocide, nor genocide war, except in the sick rhetoric of its perpetrators. A growing consensus of domestic and international opinion is appalled when counterinsurgency campaigns veer toward the mass killing of entire populations, or when governments use foreign wars to root out and exterminate domestic opponents. As for the blatant slaughter of entire groups during peacetime, international opinion simply cannot accept that governments have the right to liquidate entire groups based on nothing more than their race, ethnicity, or religious affiliation. The Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide serves as a first step in confronting the crime that knows no name. The Convention, along with the work of scholars, survivors, and institutions devoted to understanding the Holocaust, sought to ensure that never again would be more than rhetoric. Yet, as genocide after genocide unfolded since 1945 with little effective reaction, a growing number of people realized that one needed more than treaties, proclamations, and laws condemning genocide. One needed action. Cambodia, Rwanda, and the Balkans served as wake-up calls. Since then, a host of organizations and individuals has taken it upon themselves to spur the public conscience. Within the last 10 years, politicians from both the Democratic and Republican parties spoken out against genocide. The Secretary General of the United Nations has written an action plan to prevent genocide, and the President of the United States has included the topic of genocide prevention and the National Security Strategy of the United States. Despite this, operational concepts for stopping mass killing have been in short supply. This volume seeks to address the deficit by examining historical examples of genocide and genocide prevention. The case studies ask what was done and what might have been done, with Stephens, Stanley, Reeves, and Boyer offering both historical overviews and suggestions for the future. This volume focuses on one narrow component to genocide prevention and intervention, the use of air power in stopping mass killings. If it in any way contributes to framing operational responses to the outbreak of genocide, the authors will have accomplished their contributors. Purpose. Lieutenant Colonel Aaron Stephens, U.S. Air Force, is the Chief International Developmental Fighter Programs for the Deputy Undersecretary of the Air Force International Affairs in Washington, D.C. He graduated from the U.S. Air Force Academy in 1992 with a Bachelor of Science in Aeronautical Engineering degree and also holds a Master of Military Operational Art and Science degree from Air Command and Staff College, Maxwell Air Force Base, Alabama, and a Master of Science degree from the College for Financial Planning, Phoenix, Arizona. He is a career fighter pilot with over 2,000 hours in the mighty F-16, including more than 200 combat missions over Iraq, the former Yugoslavia, and Afghanistan. Lieutenant Colonel Keith Reeves, U.S. Air Force, is a 15-year Air Force veteran from Indianapolis, Indiana. He graduated from the United States Air Force Academy in 1992 and holds a Master of Engineering degree from the University of Colorado. Colonel Reeves started his career as a developmental engineer at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio, prior to entering pilot training. He then flew B-52s from Barksdale Air Force Base, Louisiana, and held many positions, including instructor pilot and wing combat plans officer. Colonel Reeves then transitioned to the B-2 at Whiteman Air Force Base, Missouri, flew combat during Operation Iraq Freedom, and instructed at the B-2 Formal Training Unit. In 2005, he attended the Air Command and Staff College. He is a senior pilot with more than 2,500 hours. He is currently Chief of Air and Ground Dominance at Air Combat Command Headquarters, Langley Air Force Base, Virginia. Commander Timothy E. Boyer, U.S. Navy, is a 1991 graduate of Purdue University with a Bachelor of Science degree in Civil Engineering. A naval flight officer, he has accumulated more than 2,700 hours in the E-2C Hawkeye. He has served operational tours with several East Coast Courier Airborne Early Warning Squadrons deploying to the Mediterranean and Arabian Gulf areas of operations on USS America CV-66, USS John F. Kennedy, CV-67, and USS George Washington, CVN-73. He attended Air Command and Staff College and received a Master of Military Operational Art and Science degree. He is currently serving as an Information Operations Planner and Chief of the U.S. Central Command Support Division at the Joint Information Operations Warfare Command at Lackland Air Force Base, Texas. Major General Stanley, U.S. Air Force, is a native of Memphis, Tennessee, and graduated from the U.S. Air Force Academy in 1994 with a Bachelor's of Science degree in Biochemistry. He attended undergraduate pilot training at Columbus Air Force Base, Mississippi. and A-10 initial qualification training at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, Arizona. He has flown the A-10 from Pope Air Force Base, North Carolina, Asan Air Base, Republic of Korea, and the A-10 formal training unit at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, with two deployments in support of Operation Southern Watch. He attended Air Command and Staff College in 2005 and graduated with a Master's of Arts in Military Operational Art and Science degree. He is a senior pilot with over 1,700 hours and is currently serving as the A-10 Functional Area Manager at the Air Combat Command Langley Air Force Base.